So let's continue with our look at Grand Rapids in the early 1930s. We've seen that changing the names of the streets did not entail any much controversy or difficulty, and that was done in Grand Rapids. But although that happened easily enough, that certainly was not the case when a proposal to change the name of the town evoked much debate and argument and some very hard feelings. Members of the commercial club had advocated the change because so many other states, and particularly Michigan, also had towns called Grand Rapids. Mail and shipment of goods or equipment were frequently delayed because of delivery to the wrong place. For that reason, Grand Rapids, Wisconsin, had recently become Wisconsin Rapids. As the campaign to change the name of the Minnesota town proceeded, many opposed the action on purely sentimental grounds. Rumors had it that a plot to ram a change through was afoot. Fake news isn't new. It's been around for a long time, and that certainly was the case here. The Herald Review, which supported the proposal to change the name, was accused of doing so in order to obtain orders for new stationery and envelopes. Well, hardly. A quite bizarre charge was also leveled and believed by some, that once the name was changed, the paper company could avoid local taxes. Well, fake news again, indeed. Charles Blandon, whose paper company had experienced frequent misdelivery of mail and orders, and on one occasion suffered a month's delay of badly needed replacement parts erroneously sent to Michigan, urged the commercial club to work for the name change. Some thought the newcomer, meaning Blandon, was presumptuous in his request, although his interest was merely practical. Against the backdrop of suspicion and unwarranted controversy, the council considered suggestions such as Itasca City, Mesabi Center, Pokegama, Wabana, and Alpine. A city election scheduled to settle the matter was canceled, and the council instead called for an unofficial straw ballot to assess public opinion. Mesabi Rapids won many votes in that contest. And I found that interesting. That would have been an appropriate name, Mesabi Rapids. The Canisteo District, which bordered on Grand Rapids on the western edge of the Mesabi, was named using a Seneca Indian word, which meant head of navigation. And that had been totally forgotten by 1930s. Only did I find that many, many years later, trying to figure out where the chosen name had come from. And one of the early officers of the Oliver Iron Mining Company had grown up in Canisteo, New York. So writing to them, I learned about the Seneca Indian origin and the meaning of the word. That would have been kind of nice. They named their district the Canisteo District to give kind of an honorary place to Grand Rapids, and this would have returned the favor. But at any rate, other choices were Le Rapids, La Rapids, The Rapids, Itasca Rapids, Pine Rapids, Long Rapids, that was the original Indian name for the place, Range Rapids, Minnesota Rapids, Iron Rapids, Indian Rapids, Alpine Rapids, Minnetaska, Rapitaska, Rapid City, all of those received support. 5 votes were for the name Blandon, and years later, the untrue story circulated that Blandon had tried to rename the town in his own behalf. But the largest number, more than 200 of the unofficial ballots, favored no change at all. The matter was dropped, the familiar retained. Transportation to and from Grand Rapids had changed considerably in the early 1930s. A 1932 editorial in the Herald Review noted that once in a while a passenger could be seen, but most often the train thunders in and nobody gets on or off. The locomotive whistles its way out of town, an interesting relic of the days that were. The possibility of establishing an airport to serve Grand Rapids was discussed, but significant air travel for the town was still far in the future. The few who desired could make arrangements for charter seaplanes to land in a nearby lake or a smaller planes at the landing field in Coleraine. In the meantime, the much improved Minnesota highway network that resulted from the Good Roads program of earlier years had led to dependence on motor vehicles. Bus travel was much more frequent, and the Greyhound line in 1932 advertised a Thanksgiving special. A 25-cent return trip was offered with the purchase of a full-price ticket to any destination. But but primarily realization of the potential of the automobile and truck provided easy and convenient travel and shipping. The bridge across the Mississippi River connecting North and South Pokegama Avenue appeared to most an anachronism in the modern age of the 1930s. The pride of the community when completed in 1901, the steel structure had been designed for buckboards, not for cars and trucks. By 1930, it was too narrow, too crowded, and quite unsafe. The Army Corps of Engineers blocked construction of a new bridge temporarily for reasons that, according to the Herald Review, everyone had given up trying to know. When permission to replace the existing structure was eventually obtained and a $62,000 bid accepted, the project was underway. Forms for the concrete arches for the new bridge were in place, and what the Herald Review referred to as spectacular construction work drew many spectators. Elaborate plans for a grand opening of the bridge were made despite depressed times. Contributions were received from most of the Grand Rapids businessmen and professionals. Weather was ideal on dedication day. The schools closed in honor of the event, and the Deer River Grand Rapids football game that started the festivities was well attended. After the game, the famous Grand Rapids High School Blend and Paper Company Band was on hand to play music, and that really is a misnomer. That wasn't its name. Either the Herald Review just put it that way. It's a high school band that was sponsored by the Blend and Paper Company. And I'm looking at a picture of that band, and it's very impressive. Impressive uniform, sharp-looking caps. They've got capes as a part of it, all dressed alike and looking very snappy. It was indeed one of the better Minnesota State high school bands. An afternoon parade featured vintage cars, including one of the oldest in the state. Congressman Pittenger was the main speaker of the day, and prominent Grand Rapids merchant C.C. Peterson read his poem about the bridge. I always like reading C.C. Peterson's stuff. I've mentioned him on occasion before in our series. He was the proprietor of the Itasca Mercantile. He wrote a very witty weekly column in the Grand Rapids Herald Review, and his pronouncements were oftentimes very wryly done and nicely done. But this poem leaves something to be desired. One of the prominent lines in it, "I am a monument of progress and the product of modern road construction." Now, I kind of pass on that poem. But anyway, the bridge dedication did have its poetry. The crowd was estimated at 7,000 people, and all agreed the day was one to be long remembered. That bridge dedication was the major Grand Rapids civic event of the early 1930s, but there were many other sources of entertainment. The new Rialto Theater opened with much fanfare featuring a Constance Bennett film. Sound movies were still relatively new, and the Rialto owner emphasized that his theater had the most modern of sound systems. The Herald Review offered the owner congratulations for his investment in the town, for a good theater brings people to the community, and the newspaper also applauded his selection of films, stating that flagrantly sexy pictures only encourage folks to stay at home, and no such were to be shown in that theater. Traveling vaudeville shows were no longer among the entertainment mainstays, but an occasional act, usually in conjunction with a film, did appear. Capitan, son of the famous dog star Rin Tin Tin, was one of the featured visitors to Grand Rapids in 1932. Concerts and musical offerings were frequently scheduled. Among the high points of 1932 was the appearance of the Lombardi Concert Company and French operatic singer Victoria Boucher, accompanied by what the Herald Review described as high-class instrumental artists. The Grand Rapids High School Band played well-attended Sunday afternoon concerts, sometimes in conjunction with the Girls Glee Club and the Grand Rapids Male Quartet. Grand Rapids talent performed elsewhere as well. The Blandin-sponsored band made well-publicized trips to the State Fair to play for appreciative audiences there in 1931 and 32. Dancing remained a popular pastime in the Grand Rapids of the 1930s. Neighboring farmers drew good-sized crowds at lively barn dances. The new City Hall soon became a major social as well as civic center. The spacious second story had a hardwood floor ideal for dancing. One longtime Grand Rapids resident lamented in 1982 that when the upstairs big room was carpeted and used for office space, all the fun and gaiety of the hall were lost. The Old Settlers' Ball was still one of the year's major social events, although, as noted in the Herald Review in 1932, very few people were left who had lived in Grand Rapids before the installation of the light plant. The spirit of long residency in the community still served as a bond of friendship, though. The popular Swanson's Orchestra provided music that year for those who had lived in the community since before 1908 and who jealously guarded their right to attend. Grand Rapids lost two of its most notable citizens in 1932. Dan Gunn had continued to be involved and engaged in many interests until just a few months before his death at the age of 72. Appropriately, the Herald Review commented that Gunn had served the public unstintingly, giving his time and financial assistance to a multitude of worthy causes. Gunn had lived in Grand Rapids for 40 years, and the newspaper that stated, after all that time, we have yet to hear a single word which would reflect adversely on his integrity. To engage in business for four decades with a record of complete integrity is a great tribute. C.C. McCarthy stepped forward at the graveside service for Gunn to deliver what was to be one of his own last public addresses. He spoke of the changes in Grand Rapids since he and Dan Gunn had first arrived. He attributed the town's progress to community leaders, praising Gunn as one of the most active and able. McCarthy had lost none of his flair for words, and he concluded, "If each and all for whom he performed some generous service were to come today and place upon his grave their tribute of gratitude and love, he would sleep beneath a monument grander than ever sculptor wrought or artist dreamed." Yeah, that's McCarthy. But just a few months later, Chauncey McCarthy, dean of the Itasca County Bar, active to his 76th year, followed Dan Gunn in death. McCarthy's funeral was attended by people from many parts of the state. The Herald Review spoke of McCarthy's striking appearance with his white hair and of his eloquence, and it concluded that he had left a splendid mark on his community and country. A very nice tribute.